My fellow investors, welcome back to the Newcomer Investor channel. Whether you're new or experienced, everyone's welcome. Now on this channel, we talk about great businesses and we make investing accessible and fun for everyone. I'm your host, Anthony. Welcome back to the show. Now, before we get started, as always, my friends, I have to remind you that nothing I say is financial advice. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just telling you what I do. But on this journey of learning to be a better investor, I've made a lot of mistakes. And so as a result, I'd highly encourage you to always do your own research. Now, a few topics I want to talk about today, none of them connected, so we'll just take them one by one. The first is, I am very, very excited. As I have publicly said, probably on every episode, I have way too many holdings, right? When you have a lot of stocks, obviously you do benefit from diversification. It's nice knowing that, you know, if one of your companies fail, your portfolio will still exist, you'll still probably do well. However, there comes a point when, you know, you over-diversify, you just have too much, and it doesn't really add a lot of benefit. However, it does make you stretch your brain to the point where you don't have the bandwidth to really follow these stocks properly, right? And that's my problem that I've had, that I am slowly trying to, solve one stock at a time. So I've made a commitment to reduce the size of the portfolio. I'm hoping to get it down to around 25. That's my, you know, medium-term objective. Obviously, I'm not, you know, just like immediately cutting or selling everything. I think that, you know, some stocks are worth waiting to sell. And I'm very pleased to say today I have exited a position, one that I've held for a couple of years at least, I think 3 years. And that business is Aecon Group. Now, Aecon is a major national specialized construction company. Specifically, they build large infrastructure projects, you know, projects that very few people, if any, can actually build, right? So we're talking about, you know, supporting building pipelines, nuclear stations, airports. So there's actually a lot to like in that space, you know. When you are a type of company that has that, you know, depth of knowledge that is able to deliver these projects, usually, you know, whenever a government or anyone wants to build something, they'll kind of just go to you, right? So they've never had a problem finding contracts in order to build new stuff. That gives them a moat, essentially. Their future prospects also look very good, in my opinion, considering the fact that while it is not, you know, a renewable company, for example, they are involved in the process of decarbonization initiatives, right? When we're talking about, you know, fixing or replacing a grid or something like that, they are usually involved in that type of stuff. And actually, you know, they've had a lot of collaborations with some renewable companies that I like. Even one that I own called Northland Power. I know they worked on something together. So they're involved in all these large infrastructure things. They have also been financially responsible. You know, they were able to increase the dividend every year for, I believe, over 10 years. And they've actually just increased it again. It was a small, I think, 2.8% increase. But still, they're able to keep doing that. And they are committed to continue doing that. So that's something, obviously, that investors enjoyed. The other thing that is nice about this business, and at least that's what I liked when I was buying it, was that a Chinese corporation attempted to purchase it for $1.5 billion. And that was, I believe, 6 years ago. And it didn't happen because the government blocked it. Because as you would know, right, governments can say no to certain things. So they said no. But if you look at the market cap now, it's just over $1 billion. So technically, right, a foreign company wanted to buy it for 50% more than the current price. That's quite attractive when you think about it. Okay, now, if everything's so great about this company, well, why did I sell? Two reasons. I mean, the first is, like I said, I just want to slim down the portfolio anyway. So I prefer to sell businesses in which I am, you know, less knowledgeable or just less a fan of. So that's one reason. But the second is the type of business that it is. It is highly cyclical. It has times when it just does very, very well and times when it's just awful. We just happen to be at a time when things are kind of awful. Inflation really affects these types of construction businesses, especially this one where they had a whole group of legacy projects where they earned a fixed revenue, but their cost base just ballooned like crazy again because of inflation. And they don't have much control over that kind of stuff, right? So basically, it is the opposite of an all-weather business. It is a business that, depends a lot on the macro circumstances and external factors. And that is really something that I do not like and that I am trying to shift my portfolio away from. I want to have a business that does well regardless of if we have inflation or not, whether we have a recession or not. and Akon doesn't quite fit that category, at least for now. Even though, again, it is resilient, and I do think it'll continue to exist. But still, now the good news is the stock has really come back. I was down 50% at some point on this one, and now I was able to sell it, had a 0% capital gain return. I literally broke even, but of course I collected the dividends, so that's good. I also owned it in a separate account previously. I made a better return on that, but that I had sold like months ago. So now I am fully sold out, and you know, I wish this business all the best, but I don't have plans to come back. Shifting to our next topic, I want to talk a little bit about banks. As you know, or don't know, I own three banks currently, and I've owned them for years, actually, all three of them. So I own Scotiabank, which is the oldest one, TD, and EQB. Now, TD, you know, very boring. Nothing really happens. It's kind of just stable, and it's just chilling, so that's good. Very happy with that one. I don't really think about it much. Scotiabank has been extremely frustrating for the last, you know, few years. And I've spoken about this one publicly, right? I've defended it, saying, you know what, it's not that bad, but honestly, it has been subpar in terms of its performance so far, especially in some countries in Latin America. Not all of them. The Mexico franchise has been good, but some of the others not so good. But I did have some hopes that with the new CEO, Scott Thompson, who's been here for, I think, more than a year now, things would slowly start to improve, and it seems like they are improving. So they reported earnings the other day, which turned out to be a little better than expected. Honestly, I think we all got used to Scotiabank just not really delivering results that it surprised everyone. And the stock, which had not been doing well for a few months, has kind of started to come back a little. So I'm actually quite pleased with that. Over the long term, I will be honest with you, I don't know how long I'm going to keep this one. I think, you know, at these current levels, you know, I might as well hold on to it. I almost see it like a cash position that delivers me a very high dividend because my average cost is in the 50s, so it's quite low. But, you know, if it moves up enough, I do think it may be time to rotate that cash into a better compounder. And I know, you know, that I'm contradicting something I would have said like a year ago, right? But I do think part of the journey of being an investor and even having a podcast, right, is, you know, you get to see my shifting thinking in real time, and it's totally fine to be able to say like, oh man, maybe I got this one wrong, right? So I still don't think it's a bad bank or a bad investment, but it is getting harder and harder to look at the performance of this bank versus other banks and still choose to stay with that one, right? And that's the part that's still kind of like, oh, that I'm really seeing, which leads me to the superstar of this discussion, my friends. EQB is undeniably Canada's best bank. I never fail to be impressed by this bank. It's like every single result that they have, I'm like, wow, I can't believe this happened. Now, if you don't know, EQB, they brand themselves as Canada's challenger bank. Their whole corporate messaging is basically about how, you know, the big six banks have failed us. They charge us fees. Their interest rates are low. And we're basically leaving money on the table by banking with the big six instead of EQB, which has no overhead costs because it's a digital bank. And so they pass on the savings to customers, right? And as a customer and a shareholder, I agree. You know, the thing that I think about a lot in business and in our, you know, capitalist system is that a lot of time, if as a shareholder you are successful and the business is successful, it's because the customers kind of get screwed over, right? Now, I'm not saying that always happens, but it is a pretty common thing. But in the case of EQB, it's literally the opposite. The customers and the shareholders are winning. They are providing the most value. And you're seeing this in, if you look at their Q4 presentation, they are on track to be basically deliver the best 20-year total shareholder return of any bank listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange and in the S&P 500 in the US. That is a big deal. We're looking at a over 1,000% total shareholder return. That's a compound annual growth rate of 13%. This has happened because they keep hitting their financial targets, consistent return on equity over 15%, consistent growth in their, you know, diluted earnings per share, consistent dividend increases. I mean, is it me or is every quarter they're announcing a new dividend increase, right? Something like that. I mean, it's literally, I've never seen this in any other bank ever. And so, to be honest, it makes sense then that they would deliver such great results in terms of the stock as well. So, very proud to be a shareholder of EQB. It's one of my best performers. Like, it's really been just compounding away. And I look forward to seeing the continued growth. They also launched a campaign called the Second Chance marketing campaign. It's brilliant, to be honest. It stars the father-son duo of the Canadian show called Schitt's Creek. They're very famous. This is very fun. It's basically the dad being like, oh, son, do you still use your first ever bank account that I signed you up on, right? Which would basically be one of the big six. And the son being like, yeah, I do. And then the dad says, well, okay, it's actually not good. Let me sign you up with EQB. And it's amazing. And they did a version for the Quebec market as well, because they just entered Quebec. And again, I'm expecting great progress in that regard. I mean, when you have the best product on the market and a mission that is undeniably a good one for consumers, it's hard to imagine you not continuing to win, right? So I'm very optimistic about this one. And again, now when I compare this to Scotiabank, I keep thinking, maybe it's time to rotate more of my capital. And honestly, otherwise, as long as EQB keeps moving up, it may even just surpass Scotiabank just from a capital appreciation perspective anyway, right? So anyway, I did add a little bit more to my position. And, you know, on each dip, I think I'm just going to continue doing that. Okay, moving on to our next topic, and the most important one for today at least, Franco-Nevada. They've just reported earnings, and there's lots to talk about. Now, if you've never heard of this company, I'd highly recommend you listen to episode 69 of the Newcomer Investor channel. That might give you some good context on the company. We did kind of a presentation on it and why I had first invested in it. But I can also give you a very quick summary quickly again. Basically, Franco is, I believe, in Canada, is the largest royalties company for gold and precious metals. So really, the business model, the way it's different from a standard mining company is, well, your average gold miner will go to a mine and take their people, their employees, and they'll start actually mining, right? That's very expensive. You have to deal with the labor costs, the regulatory costs. There's all kinds of stuff going on, and it's very stressful and just a whole lot of work. And usually you have a lot of debt too. What's different with a company like Franco-Nevada is they don't do any of that. They are basically just a bunch of finance guys that look at the potential that they could get out of whatever mines across the world. And then they go to a miner and they say, listen, we know that it's expensive to start up the operations of a mine, so here's, let's say, $10 million, and in exchange for this $10 million, you will just give us 2% of everything you get out of the mine over the course of the mine's lifetime. Now, the most attractive part of this model is they don't have to deal with issues like inflation, right? Inflation is something that affects labor costs. So the people that are actually doing the mining, all of a sudden, that really kills them. But for a royalty company, doesn't matter. You just signed a contract. You just have a claim to a percentage of whatever comes out of the mine, but your cost base doesn't really move. So the CFO, Sandeep Rana, talked about this on the earnings call. So I'm reading what he said. He said, we consider our cost structure to essentially be fixed. The other cost component for the company besides the cost of sales is our corporate admin costs. But the royalty streaming business model is a scalable model. Our corporate admin costs have increased at a much slower rate than our revenue. Revenue has increased eightfold from 2008. While corporate admin costs has less than doubled over the same period. Management believes we can continue to add to our portfolio and grow our business without adding significant overhead to the company. End quote. Now, that's something we like to see from a compounder. Something else that they have that they always bring up, and it's so important for a company like this, is the two types of optionality, being price optionality and land optionality. Price optionality is the idea that when they sign the contract, usually they do it under the assumption of, you know, the price of gold will be X price, or the price of X, you know, resource, whether it's copper or something like that, will be X price. And so they have a minimum guarantee here. But if the price of these resources goes up, that just totally increases the amount of money that they make, but again, without increasing the costs at all. And the land optionality piece is even cooler. It's the idea that, again, when they purchase, you know, a claim to a piece of a mine, that's of the known resources that are there. But what happens as the mine, you know, continues to evolve is that the miner, so that the actual operator, usually they're incentivized to keep drilling, keep exploring. And if they find more stuff, Franco still has a claim to the extra new stuff that they're finding. And so the result is you have existing mines with existing lifetimes that we know about. But in many cases, these lifetimes just keep increasing, and Franco is just making a fortune on old mines that no one thought would be that important, and that are still kicking back cash flow to this day. So now you combine this price optionality with the land optionality, with the scalability of the business model, combine that with the fact that they have $2.4 billion in available cash flow ready to deploy to buy more assets, and they have zero debt, and all of a sudden you have a very strong company. Now, the update we've all been waiting for is the Cobre Panama mine. Again, highly recommend you listen to episode 69 to get the context of this. But again, the spark notes of that is basically the Panama government has decided, well, Supreme Court has chosen to make the Panama government close down the Cobre Panama mine, which was the largest copper mine, I believe, in South America. It's 5% of Panama's GDP, 7,000 direct jobs, 40,000 indirect jobs. That's a huge chunk. That's more than Saskatchewan's GDP is to Canada, right? Just to give you an idea. And Franco had a claim to that mine. It's operated by First Quantum Minerals, which is a Canadian company too. And so we'd all been waiting for, like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Because that's 20% of Franco's revenues. Well, Franco has officially said now, plan A, they are hoping that the Panama government, basically after an election that's coming up later this year, that after they do that and they realize that it's destroying their economy, that they will change their mind and reopen the mine. That's plan A. But plan B is arbitration under the Canada-Panama Free Trade Agreement. Corporations that find themselves in a situation like this, where, I mean, they've invested significant amounts of money in a country and all of a sudden their property gets taken away, they are allowed to essentially kind of sue the country to try and get their money back. Now, Franco has taken a over $1 billion impairment charge on the mine. So in accounting, that basically means that they just like reversed that off of their balance sheet. So they took a $1 billion loss. It was just a significant amount, but they are seeking $5 billion in damages. Again, that's in plan B for that arbitration. And they expanded in the call because I was wondering, where does that $5 billion come from? It's basically because of the market cap decline of the company itself, because they said, again, 20% of their revenue was hit, but it's even more than that they lost in market cap because of this decision that came straight out of Panama. So they will seek this money, and honestly, I'm optimistic. Obviously, I'm not a lawyer or anything, right? It's not like I know really what's going on, but I have tried to look at similar cases from other countries, and it does seem like usually companies have a very good case to make for stuff like that, and they do get lots of money back. And again, in a case like this, I mean, this was egregious, right? They spent so much money on this mine, and now they're, you know, they lost 20% of revenue. That's a big deal. And Panama, of course, does not want to be North Korea. Panama is a country that wants to be able to trade with the world. And, you know, part of the condition for trading with the world is they have to respect these free trade agreements and they have to compensate if they make decisions like this. So I'm quite optimistic. And as the CEO has said, his name is Paul Brink, he said, listen, it's only upside from here. The stock price has been beaten up more than the amount of revenue that has been lost. So now, we're assuming, you know, this mine is just dead to us, whatever, we keep going, we've got a great business anyway, but if we get any news from this mine, it'll likely be positive, and that's going to be a very good catalyst for the stock. So anyway, I've continued adding to it. It's still a small position of the overall portfolio, it's 1.6% of portfolio, so it's very small, but I believe I will continue adding throughout the year. I really believe in this company. I think, especially for a long-term hold, it has every aspect that you would want out of a major compounder, right? So, you know, companies like Franco, like EQB, Alimentation Couche-Tard, Brookfield, these are the type of single stocks that I really see myself, you know, really adding to throughout the year, more than the high-yield ones. And for example, when I was talking about maybe rotating Scotiabank, you know, if I did, it would go into businesses like this or into ETFs for sure. Over the short term, these compounders can go anywhere, right? It can fall another 30%, though I doubt it would happen, but it can. But over, let's say, the next 10 years, I'm actually extremely confident that Franco is going to do very well. And so, yeah, I look forward to it being a meaningful part of the portfolio. Okay, final topic, which, you know, we have to discuss it very briefly because we're all talking about it online, right? It's Bitcoin. Listen, my friends. I am actually neither a Bitcoin fan nor a Bitcoin hater, believe it or not. I used to own a little bit of Bitcoin. I sold it to buy Brookfield Infrastructure because I bought that huge Brookfield dip, if you'll remember. No regrets. But yes, since then, Bitcoin has gone crazy, right? It's going up. And now we are back in this thing where everyone talks about, you know, putting their entire savings into Bitcoin. And again, this is not financial advice, right? I genuinely have no idea what's going to happen. But I would advise caution. You know, same as what I said in that other episode about Nvidia. When you reach a time when everyone, including people who have no clue about investing, you know, random people, like let's say at your work or on the street, when these people are all talking about, oh my God, I got to put all my money in there, that is when you should be scared. You should be putting your money in stuff when no one knows about it or no one's talking about it. Those are the people that make the money off of Bitcoin, right? So, you know, maybe it can go up more from here. Maybe it'll go up another 100% in next month. I don't know. It could. But I'm saying, don't be surprised if it falls 50% from here, right? So, you know, if you'd ask me what I'm doing about Bitcoin, I'm doing nothing. I'm staying out of this. You know, if it falls, let's say, yeah, 50% from here, maybe I'll get back into it at some point. Not because I'm treating it as an investment, but rather because I think it's okay to have, let's say, 1% of your portfolio in crypto because it's an interesting space and it is, you know, different asset class from gold and from US dollar. So I'm open to that. But otherwise, you know, there's no way you can value it because it's not a productive business that creates cash flows, right? It's just not. So, you know, invest at your own risks, but just be careful. Anyway, my friends, thank you for listening to the New Crypto Investor channel. As always, if you liked it, make sure to give us a 5-star. And yeah, thank you for listening. I look forward to connecting again with you soon.